Committee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Thursday, May 29th, and we are going to go into work session on House Bill 5021, which is the operations budget for the Department of Higher Education. I'll open the work session on House Bill 5021. I'll close the work session on House Bill 5021. No. I'll open the work session. I still can't do it with our
school board members.
We're going to forget the work session. We're just going to go into public hearing on House Bill 5021, lacking a quorum. We have before us, in response to the issues that were raised yesterday, a number of pieces of information. And we have, first of all, though, in order to not have people sit around waiting for us, Portland State University has brought folks in to talk to us about their fee remission program. And so if you would come forward and... I think we had some rather specific questions yesterday about programs that were specific to Portland State, and also questions that were revolving around the diversity scholarships, or fee remissions, rather. So if you could go ahead and talk to us about that and be prepared for questions, we'll get you on your way so you can go and do what you're supposed to be doing.
Thank you very much, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. My name is Jay Kenton, and I'm the Vice President of Finance and Administration at Portland State University. With me today is Sam Colley, Director of Admissions Records and Financial Aid at PSU, and we're here today to report to you on our use of fee remissions. Although we award both graduate assistant fee remissions and other programmatic fee remissions, I'm going to limit my comments today to the programmatic fee remissions, but would be happy to entertain any questions about graduate assistant remissions that you may have. I wanted to begin with just a brief overview of the purposes and uses of fee remissions at PSU, and then tell you how we budget and manage these programs at the university. I'll then ask Mr. Colley to discuss how we process applications and actually award these funds and the criteria that we use in doing so. I wanted to go back to 1999 first and thank you for the adoption of the RAM funding model. And at the time it was adopted, we told you that we would reach out to more students and provide merit and need-based assistance for students not otherwise served by other programs. I'm happy to report to you today that over the last 4 years we've been true to this pledge. However, this would not have been possible without the use of fee remissions. As you know, part of PSU's mission is to provide access for students who may not otherwise be able to attend a university. We take this mission seriously, and it is why we have attempted to maintain modest admission standards, reasonably priced tuition, and make our programs and services accessible and convenient to the populations we serve. One of the reasons I'm proud to work at Portland State is because we're an institution that has provided many first-generation and low-income students with an opportunity to break the mold that society has cast for them in many ways. Just yesterday, I listened to three PSU students who will graduate next month tell our foundation board about their experiences at PSU and how the education they have obtained has already changed their lives. All three of these students acknowledge the importance that financial aid and fee remissions played in allowing them to afford a college education. At PSU, we treat fee remission programs as a form of financial aid and use these funds to manage our enrollment. It allows us to be purposeful in recruiting students in order to accomplish board and institutional objectives, such as diversifying our student bodies. We provide fee remissions for high-achieving students, students in need of financial assistance, and to provide incentives for underrepresented, multicultural, and multilingual students to enter career fields in need of their participation. As you've seen from the material presented yesterday, programmatic fee remissions are a significant component of our budget. In accordance with OUS policy, we have maintained the level of fee remissions as a proportion of our tuition budget. Thus, as tuition or enrollment increases, so too do fee remission budgets. We invest in fee remissions prudently and allocate these funds to multiple institutional managers to award in accordance with predefined program criteria. These managers are charged with the responsibility to manage the budgets to ensure that awards stay within allotments. In addition, we have application and awarding processes for fee remissions that involve multiple criteria and processes. Through these various processes, we've been able to allocate these precious budgetary resources in a manner that serves the greatest number of students possible while ensuring the fiscal integrity of the institution. In closing, I ask that you give this matter serious consideration. Fee remission programs are important to our universities and provide opportunities for many students who would not otherwise be able to obtain a college degree. I'll now ask Sam Cully to describe fee remission awarding processes and the criteria that we use at Portland State University.
Good morning, Chair Morgan and members of the committee. I'm Sam Cully, Director of Admissions, Records, and Financial Aid at Portland State University. First, I would just like to give you an overview of our process in general. And the fee remission process is an integral part of our financial aid process at Portland State. There are basically two kinds of fee remissions that we administer, those being merit fee remissions and need-based fee remissions. The largest need-based fee remission, the Oregon University Supplemental Tuition Grant, or fee remission, is administered strictly on a need-based criteria, and I package that in financial aid award packages on a very high need basis. And if I could just give you a quick overview of the need calculation, is we establish a cost of education each year. Financial aid offices all over the country do this. A student applies for financial aid with the Federal Free Application for Federal Aid form, the FAFSA, and in that application process, the student and family have an expected family contribution. How much money can they afford to help themselves pay for school in an average 9-month September through June time period? So we establish a cost minus any family contribution available, and sometimes that's zero and sometimes that's a lot depending upon the family. And then that establishes a need. And to give you an idea of how precious the supplemental tuition fee remission is to our students and to us as in terms of overall packaging, our award criteria for the supplemental tuition remission is an EFC of $0 to $1,200. In other words, a student whose family can afford to help, whose family cannot afford to help themselves at all, have zero money for college, and applies early, can get an Oregon supplemental tuition remission. A family who can afford $1,201 for college cannot get a fee remission. We just don't have the funds to give it to all students who might be deserving of it. So it's a very important part of financial aid packaging. The second kind, general kind of fee remission program is merit-based, and we have a very well-developed application for students and a process for students to follow to see if they can get other fee remissions, such as a PSU Laurels program or a diversity scholarship. And the application is establishes several steps for the student to follow. If it's a high school student coming in, they must submit a high school transcript to meet the minimum GPA requirements. They also need to have letters of recommendation. They also need to write an essay talking about, you know, why they want to come to Portland State and when, what their future goals are. And they also need to show some activities that they've done in high school. There's a faculty and staff committee that looks at these, and there are multiple committees, and makes selections based upon the student's high school GPA, if it's a freshman coming in, there are some for transfers, make selection based upon their writing sample, their ability to have a complete and on-time packet, which is a part of the learning process, if you will, is you might have a 4.0 who, if they didn't get their application in on time, then unfortunately they're not going to be considered. So it's a very it's not regimented, if you will, but it's an important process that students must follow and allows us to be fair and equitable for students in administering the dollars that we have. And in closing, I would like to say that from my perspective as a financial aid person, that fee remissions are an integral and very important part for access to students to Portland State and other Oregon University System institutions. And for many students, if it's a very low-income student, that extra fee remission may allow that student to actually come to Portland State and persist at Portland State. So I think it's an incredibly important process, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
We received yesterday from the Chancellor's office a series of spreadsheets that displayed a number of ways to look at fee remissions across the system and then on individual campuses. And I noticed from the information that we were given that Portland State is kind of on the low end of the fee remission scale, that the program or the concept isn't used as much on the Portland State campus as it is on some of the other campuses. And I'm speaking as a percentage of the total tuition revenue. I'm wondering if you can talk to the committee about why this is why this program isn't implemented as fully at Portland State as it is in some of the other campuses in the system.
Chair Morgan, I'll attempt to answer that question. And to begin with, we don't really know what other institutions do. I mean, we have general policy guidelines we follow from the board. Institutions have latitude to move beyond a minimal level in that regard. And at Portland State University, in 1999, when tuition was decentralized and allowed to be retained at campuses, we established a policy whereby we would hold our fee remissions at the level they were roughly at that time, which is about 7% of our tuition income. This is programmatic fee remissions. And we have maintained that level. Other institutions do have the prerogative to go beyond that if they would like. We simply haven't felt that we had the financial resources to do that.
And when you say 7%, you're talking about considering the remissions for graduate assistants in a separate category than the fee remissions for the undergraduates?
That's right.
Because the data that we have indicates that you're actually in the 12-13% range, so I would assume then that you would be considering those two aspects separately.
Chair Morgan, that's absolutely correct, and I was limiting my comments to the programmatic fee remissions. We do the same with graduate assistant fee remissions. We budget them as a percentage of the graduate tuition. We've tried to hold that percentage constant, and it's, again, just been a budgetary management style that we've chosen at Portland State to maintain those levels at a relatively consistent basis.
So have you found that the policy that you've adopted to keep fee remissions at a relatively low level has impacted your ability to attract applicants?
Chair Morgan, I would say our enrollment is at record levels, and therefore, I mean, we could always use more money in these categories. However, we've tried to prudently manage our affairs, keep our budgets in balance, and maintain the fiscal integrity of the institution. And we've probably been a little conservative in this regard, but we felt that prudent given the economic circumstances of the state today.
To kind of change gears here, one of the things that we asked to have submitted to the committee today was by campus the list of eligibility criteria for the Diversity Initiative Tuition Remission Program. Do you have that information for us?
Chair Morgan, for the record, Dave McDonald, Chancellor's Office. That was included in the packet at your desk as well, and it has as its
Well, and I do plan to have you take us through those items, so let's just defer that issue until we get to that place. I want to give these people a chance to get back to their real jobs. Is there any other questions from the committee? Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I was gone yesterday, and so if I'm asking questions you've answered already, please feel free to say so, and I'll get them from the chair. On your fee remission program, I have two major questions. First off, how does it affect tuition for other students? Does it net effect raise tuition for other students if that program went away, or is it a neutral program? And tied into that is really the second question. Some of the other universities have told me that the admission program actually brings more money in. They feel they're allowed to attract out-of-state non-resident students, bring them in at a higher tuition, somewhat less than it would be if they came in straight without remission, but because they only get a partial remission, but they feel it might be a net positive effect. But I haven't heard or seen figures on that. Do you have any sense of where the remission program is as far as Portland State is concerned?
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, indeed that is true, what you just said, with non-resident students in particular. Our non-resident students pay in excess of $13,000 tuition per year. By discounting that slightly and attracting, in particular, high-achieving students from neighboring states, we've found that it has benefited us financially. With regard to other fee remission programs, would that impact tuition? I don't know that it actually would, to be honest with you, although it is viewed as a tuition discount of sorts in our accounting records. We believe that by having, you know, a diverse student body and attracting students who wouldn't otherwise come to PSU, that we're embellishing the experience and attracting other students who want to come and be part of that experience at the university. So we believe that it's integral to our mission to diversify our student body and to bring in students who wouldn't otherwise be there and allow them to have experiences with the students that would come regardless of the financial situation.
Madam Chair, let me ask the question a little different way because that wasn't what I was asking.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm trying to make my question clear. I'm not saying you shouldn't have a remission program. I'm not saying it doesn't do all the things you just said it did, and it may well be worthwhile doing it on that basis. And I'm not necessarily opposed to transferring tuition money from one student to another or tuition costs from one student to another, okay? I mean, I'll give my own example. I could afford to pay more tuition for my kids at U of O if I knew it was going for a kid that couldn't get in any other way. Okay, so I'm not necessarily opposed to that. What I do want to know, though, is that does the overall program mean that certain students are paying more tuition than others if the admission program went away? Are you bringing in overall more money because of out-of-state students, or are you having as a global program, is it a net loss? Does all the things you want to do, but it's a net loss, and it means higher tuition for some students.
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, I would say probably the latter, to be very candid with you.
Thank you for your honesty. And I'm not saying it's a bad program, but I do appreciate your honesty. Madam Chair.
Follow up.
One last question. This is on the remission program, too. What is the graduation rate for those students who receive the remissions?
I don't have that today. I'm sure we could get that. Dave, do you?
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, if I may, the data we have indicates that students who receive non-loan-based aid, in other words, a remission or a scholarship of some sort, do graduate at a higher rate. This is confirmed by a budget note study that the Oregon Opportunity or the Oregon Student Assistance Commission presented in 2002 regarding the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which largely serves the same students, and national data also supports this. Interim or preliminary data from OUS shows that students who do receive non-loan-based aid have higher GPAs at the end of the first year, which is certainly an indication of greater likelihood of success towards graduation.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to see those figures broken out by university for both remission and Oregon Opportunity Grants, because the data I've seen does not support that. It's important that at the community college level, the Opportunity Grant is very effective in raising graduation rates. But that at the OUS level, it makes a very minimal difference. And I'd like to see those figures if I could, please.
We'll provide that for you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Just follow up on that piece. Some of the information that's already been provided to us on graduation rates is incomplete, and I would support the request that's coming from Representative Bates. What you've already shared with us in Table 6 in the packet dated April 29th, is six-year graduation rates of OUS entering freshmen by race and ethnicity, but it covers the period 1987 through 1995. So any data that's more recent than that would be most helpful, and the inclusion of gender would also give us a more complete picture, a more complete answer to the question.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley will work on that as well.
Thank you, Senator. Do you have any follow-up?
That's okay.
Any further questions on the fee remission program at Fortland State? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate you making the trip down to talk with us this morning. What I'll do now is turn the microphone over to Steve Bender. He has given us a number of pieces of information, and I'd like him to have an opportunity to take us through those so that we can get an idea of what we're looking at. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I did want to ask you all a question to start off with.
Yes.
One of the items that I will be going through today is something that was distributed back on Tuesday, and that is this memo that we started working through labeled Part 1. And we're also going to be looking at this. My question is, if any of you do not have that with you, let me know, and we'll get copies made and have that brought in before we get to that part. But if you do have that, we will be continuing with that piece. Does everyone have one? There's? Okay, great. I wanted to just wrap up briefly with the fee remission item. I don't want to spend much time on this because I know there you have a great deal still to cover in your work sessions. But just to note a couple items that were distributed to you, one of these was a table that looks like this that you should have. I know there's a lot of loose papers, but, or maybe I didn't, did I? Yes. And this was prepared by OUS, and it deals with some of the issues of how much remains being paid in tuition by students who are receiving fee remissions. So, for example, the Supplemental Tuition Grant Program, that is the need-based program, approximately $5.4 million is the amount of that fee remission. What the box to the right shows is that these students pay $15 million, roughly, in tuition, even after the fee remission is allowed. Now, this does not mean that the $15 million, that this is the net gain, because none of these students would show up if they didn't get their fee remissions. No one is categorizing or stating that. But it does say that the students who are getting the fee remissions, this particular fee remission, would have been charged about $20.5 million altogether, but they're getting $5.4 million reduction, which means what they're left paying is $15,127,000. And this shows that item for the all four of these categories.
Where do you get the $5,000 on that first line?
The first line, the $5,400,000.
Oh, okay.
It's
right
on top there.
I see it.
Yeah.
I see. Got it. Okay.
That's the amount. These numbers are consistent with the earlier figures you had for the dollar size.
Got it.
These,
so you're saying you had the 54 and the 15 million.
Right.
And you get about 20 million, which is the total cost.
Right.
But with fee remissions, it's 15.
Right. So if these fee remissions weren't offered, and every single student decided to show up anyway, and had paid the full amount, the total collection would have been about $20.5 million. Now, we don't believe that all of these students would have shown up without the tuition grant. We don't know how many would have shown up, but some number of those 6,100 are only going to this institution because of they got that fee remission program.
So, Mr. Bender, just to make sure that I'm reading this correctly, Under the Education and Diversity Initiative, mm-hmm. the amount of the fee remissions in the program is just over $13 million.
Correct.
And the amount of tuition that's paid over and above the fee remissions is about $5.5 million?
That's correct.
And so then in international programs, there's just under $3 million in fee remissions.
Right.
And it generates just over $4 million in tuition.
Right.
So relative, about half of the program is fee remitted in international programs. Is there any way to take, for example, the $3 million that is remitted in the international programs and make an estimation that if it was put into supplemental tuition grants or education diversity initiatives, how much money that would generate in tuition revenue? I recognize that this is kind of like trying to get your arms around a marshmallow.
If we talked about, for example, shifting these programs around and saying we'll take the money that's being awarded in fee remissions for international students and instead request the campuses to shift that to supplemental tuition grants instead, clearly a different set of students would be receiving the information. The difficulty would be that of the 533 recipients of the international awards, we don't know how many of those people would continue to, you know, enroll. So it wouldn't be any type of tuition estimate impact that we did would be highly speculative.
Let me also caution, this is an economic development tool. By bringing in international students, you're only seeing the tuition here. They're also paying rent, they're buying food. You know, maybe they're buying cars. These kind of international programs bring us, one, prestige, and are help with our international foreign policy down the line, because we have students from Morocco, from all over the world.
Well, and Representative March, I'm not advocating to get rid of it. I'm just trying to get some relative values here. And I would submit to you that all of these students, regardless of how they're getting into the system, are paying rent and buying groceries and doing all that kind of stuff.
But there's a difference if you're bringing them in from outside than if they're within the state already. That, i.e., it's like foreign trade. If you're expanding your foreign trade, you're bringing in new dollars. If you're keeping it for students within the system, you're not bringing in dollars from out of state.
That's why it would be difficult to do a tuition estimate. You can clearly see that some of these awards are much more lucrative and cover a higher proportion of the total tuition than others. That is also shown here.
Further questions or comments? Senator Mezzali, you look like you might need to say something. Okay, let's continue to move on then.
Madam Chair?
Representative Bates.
I don't mean to disagree with Representative Marsh, and I do disagree sometimes. I'm still troubled by a system in which taxpayers in Oregon are supplementing non-residents and international students potentially, while students within our state who come from low-income homes or who are from ethnic backgrounds that traditionally don't go on to higher education are having a difficult time getting through our system when their parents are paying taxes in the state. And the people from Morocco, frankly, haven't paid taxes in the state for 20 or 30 years. I just have a problem with that basic policy. Unless they're bringing in enough money to not only help fund their own education, but the tuition, even with the discount, is high enough to only cover their education, but help other students in our state that are residents. If that's the case, I have no problem. But if it's truly a drain financially, even a small one, into those groups, while I have personal experience with students that cannot go on to higher education, their parents are paying taxes in the state, I have a problem with that. And I always will have a problem with that. It's a basic problem of fairness. And if they can convince me that the remission program actually brings in dollars we wouldn't have otherwise and actually helps fund other students in the state, I've got no problem with it. right now I'm kind of in a quandary when I look at some of these programs.
Does anyone want to address that from the university system?
For the record, again, Dave McDonald, Chancellor's Office. Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, I appreciate your concerns. The concerns of equity are certainly paramount to what we do. As you look at these programs, especially the international program, it may be helpful to understand that it's a much more complex relationship than simply bringing in the students, because these are reciprocal agreements that allow our students to go to other countries and study abroad at discounted rates while they're at those countries. So they are very much, for every student we bring in, we are sending additional students from University of Oregon, Southern Oregon University, and our other campuses to South America or Europe or Asia to gain valuable experiences at greatly reduced rates. So there is kind of a trade flow, to use Representative March's analogy. There's kind of an import-export relationship that does benefit our students. We will work on the economic analysis for you, Representative Bates, to give you a better understanding of exactly what the net effect is on this. But these programs are more than simply bringing in students. Additionally, for every student we bring in under a remission program, it creates a critical mass that attracts other students who come in as outside the remission programs and are paying full fare, non-resident fees and tuition, so that the impact of the program goes beyond the 533 students who receive direct benefits, because international students tend to go to where there are a community of other international students of similar backgrounds for kind of a local support network within the community. So it's a more complicated issue, but we will provide additional information to help better explain it for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look forward to seeing that data. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bender.
The last item on fee remissions I just distributed to you, that is a letter to the Chancellor from the Oregon University System's General Counsel, Benjamin Rollins, addressing the issue of multi-year fee remissions and the legal implications of discontinuing a fee remission that had been awarded on a multiple-year basis. If you do look at this, I would direct you, please look at this at your leisure, but direct you to the bottom two paragraphs on the first page, which refers to the situation where fee remissions are awarded by use of a written award for, in some cases, multiple years. In the last paragraph on the first page, Mr. Rollins says that given these factors, it is my opinion that a failure by the institution to continue to honor the award when the student is met and continues to meet the established criteria would lead to significant legal exposure by the institution or to the institution. So that is the opinion of Higher Ed's General Counsel.
Mr. Bender, does LFO have any information from the system about the attrition rate in these programs? How many people don't renew?
We have some information. It's not. I would not characterize it as complete on that.
I think it would be interesting for the committee to look at the number of people that drop out of these programs. So if you could give us some kind of percentages of initial enrollment that drop out in the succeeding years of their academic careers, I think that would help us get a handle on the dimensions of this issue. Are we asking you to do something that's possible to do?
We can do it. Whether or not we can do it in 24 hours is another challenge, but we will provide the data for you.
Well, so far you've done great. So,
lack of sleep works wonders.
I appreciate that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. I appreciate very much having this letter from General Counsel Rollins. It does not tell us, however, what the total exposure might be. It makes it very clear that there could be or would lead to significant legal exposure. But I'm wondering also what the state risk pool assessment would be of this situation.
Anybody want to take a stab at that one?
Ooh.
Chancellor Jarvis?
Madam Chairman, Senator Gordley, I'm not sure I can put a figure on that. I'll try and get that for you. With the exception of the need-based awards. These are all multiple-year awards, so we'll get a figure on what that potential exposure would be. And, of course, our interest would be in us not being exposed to that and having the appropriate coverage by risk management on this, were we forced to be in that position.
And, Madam Chair, again, the follow-up question has to do with the state risk pool. Is there a way to get a statement from that entity that tells us their perspective on this?
On the nature of the risk and, yes. And just
whether they would stand behind it?
We'll be happy to pursue that, Madam Chair, Senator Gordon. If that's appropriate, if you'd like us to pursue, we'll be happy to do that.
I think what Senator Gordley is asking, and please correct me if I'm not understanding, but you want to have some kind of an assessment of the nature of the risk and how risky the risk is.
That says it.
Representative Smith.
Although I find this legal opinion interesting, I would be interested, well, I'm sure we don't have time, for me to give this legal opinion the greatest possible credence, I would have to have concurrence from the Attorney General, whether he thinks, you know, or the Department of Justice, if we are exposing ourselves to litigation on this.
Well, and what I might just also add is the system has provided us with some sample letters that are sent to students when they are when they're offered fee remissions. And so I would ask the members to take a look at this. I've just very briefly looked over them from the point of view of the contractual obligation that's put in place here with these letters.
If I may, Madam Chair, and Representative Smith, the opinion that you have was cleared by DOJ before we put it
in letter to you.
Yes. I should show that copy, I believe.
Let's continue.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative
Hart. You mentioned the need-based grants, and perhaps you would ask your counsel, is there an implied contract with need-based grants? I mean, they're awarded yearly or renewed yearly, but the presumption is that if the need still exists, that they will get the award again. And so why don't you review that question as well, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you, Representative Marsh. We will do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative March, just to clarify, it appears to me that the presumption is that if the student stays within the parameters for qualification for the grant and the need exists, then the grant will be renewed.
Right. And there's two kind of grant programs going on. One is the contractual one where it's spelled out. And then there's also they talked about the need-based grant.
The opportunity.
And, yeah, those are renewed yearly, but it's usually a kind of a pro forma review to find out if their financial situation has changed. Are they also all of a sudden making more money and don't qualify?
Okay, so. I understand. Okay, should we continue with these displays, or do we get the? Is the university system ready? Are you done with presenting your displays? Is the question I'm trying to get out.
I'm done with fee remissions.
Okay, could we have the university system come forward then and talk to us about the displays that we have that they gave us?
Oh, these are mainly my displays too.
Oh, all of these are your displays.
No, not all of them. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. I know that we have some other issues here, that information that the system has brought forward with reference to tuition remissions, and I wanted to get those into the record.
Madam Chair, for the record again, Dave McDonald. Yesterday we were requested to provide additional information, including copies of award letters, which we have provided from all campuses but Eastern Oregon, which unfortunately, because of staffing issues, was not able to send us a sample. However, the other six campuses are representative of what you would probably see from Eastern Oregon, aside from different letterhead. Additionally, we were asked to provide, for Senator Gordon in particular, information on the criteria that are used to make the diversity award, fear mission awards. And so we provided that. And as you look through this, I'll quickly summarize the broad range of topics that campuses have, with the caveat that each campus does approach the diversity awards in a unique manner to what its own campus mission is. And they have defined diversity in fairly broad manners. And I'll highlight a couple campuses just for illustrative purposes. If you would look at Portland State University, since we'll go ahead and continue to pick on them today, or use them as an example, they are the fourth page back on the packet that has OIT in the very bold lettering on the top. And I apologize not having a face page on this. But if you look at that, I'll say Portland State University Diversity Recognition Scholarship for Freshmen, the first paragraph under criteria, they list the following criteria that would be used in determining these awards. Ethnic and social economic backgrounds and with diverse talents, interests, and life experiences. And they go through the GPA and other kind of general admission requirements that would apply to any of the fear mission or scholarship programs on any campus. Again, this is an example of a very broadly framed approach in which the campus is seeking to enroll a student body that is not only diverse in its own appearance, but actually diverse in its perspective and supportive of a diverse campus environment for all students, acknowledging that a student from the South, a Caucasian student perhaps from the South, may actually enhance the diversity through their own experiences with different racial groups, their own sensitivities and own interests. So, again, it's broadly defining diversity so that it's not simply one or two races, but rather an environment that supports, you know, the broader mission of the campus in relation to diversity. And I know it's kind of talking around it, but that's the best way in which a campus can kind of approach a holistic composition.
So if I might then, I'm curious about how the campuses go about interpreting these broad-based qualifications. I'm assuming that they get, you know, half a carload of applications for this every year or every semester or whatever, and there has to be some kind of process that they go through to figure out who's going to be eligible for these or who's going to get them and who isn't going to get them.
Sure.
So is there underneath of this at the campus level some criteria by which it's decided who gets them and who doesn't get them inside of the framework of who's eligible?
Chair Morgan, perhaps I can invite Sam Colley from Portland State University, if he's still here, to provide that level of detail for the committee.
Good morning again.
Good morning again. Chair Morgan, members of the committee, for the record again, Sam Colley, Portland State University. As I described earlier, there's a process, there's an actual application packet, and that's provided both printed media and on the web now. The students can get it on the web. We have a deadline of the end of February. We have a process that includes, if it's a student coming out of high school, a process where we want I should back up and say we have an actual scholarship coordinator that looks at that has the responsibility for administering university-wide scholarships, not department scholarships such as an engineering scholarship, et cetera, or a music scholarship. That administrator administers the program by going out to high schools and doing financial aid nights, orientations, getting out in the community and doing community outreach to students in high schools and community colleges, and distributing that application either via mail requests or via the web so that we can get a broad spectrum of students who may want to apply. Once the applications come in, and that application again includes requests for high school transcripts, letters of recommendation, a writing sample, and also a need component. In other words, the student should file the federal FAFSA form so that the committee can assess need. That is not the only component, but a part of the process. And you're right, this year we had a record number of applicants for our diversity programs, and the administrator prepares the application folders for each student and gives that folder or sets of folders to a committee that's made up of faculty and college administrators, and they make a selection. The committee looks at everything from a high school GPA to a writing sample to a letter of recommendation to need, and makes a decision at the best way they can, because there are many more deserving students than we have funds for. So there's a very set process, if you will, to decide which students will receive fee remissions each year.
So is it then just subjective on the part of the members of the review committee?
I think there are subjective components, certainly. There is an objective component. There are a couple of objective components that we can point to. One would be GPA. Another would be need. So if you have a very high GPA student applying for the diversity fee remission who's also a very needy student, those are certainly objective criteria. The subjective criteria get to be, you know, how do you assess a letter of recommendation? How do you assess a student's writing sample? How do you assess the way the student articulated why he or she may want to come to Portland State and become part of the larger community? And so I would say certainly there are both objective and subjective criteria.
Do you have any idea of the relationship between the number of people that apply for fee remissions and the number of, well, let's just tailor it to the diversity initiative piece here, the relationship between the applications and the grants, the people that apply and the people that are actually successful in receiving them?
I can certainly get you that data. I don't have it today. I know this year we had a record number of applicants, and so the ratio of recipients to applicants was rather small this year. But we have a record in tandem with a record number of applications for admission, a record number in the last couple of years of applications for financial aid. But I'd be glad to try and get that data for you.
I think that would be helpful in just trying to get our eyes around the dimension of this. I think that we're all kind of mind-boggled at how the large dimensions of this program. And in my mind, I go to the place where there's fee remissions that is helping with the cost of tuition. There's also the opportunity grants and the scholarships that are administered by that commission. And then there are all of the scholarships and other programs that are aside from fee remissions that the campuses also apply to tuition issues.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Chair Morgan. Perhaps I could put that in a little perspective, and I could speak a little bit to the earlier question about the need-based fee remissions in terms of how we award those yearly. And I'd be glad to do that if you just have a minute. First, about the need-based fee remissions, we award those on a yearly basis, and we award those, and each financial aid office in the system basically operates under one of two ways of doing business. Some financial aid offices have a priority deadline. In other words, if a student applies by that deadline, then the university will assess how many students they have applied by that deadline and look at their need-based programs, and that includes federal programs and any institutional aid that we have. And we will award those programs to as many students who have met the deadline and are also qualified via our criteria. Other institutions, such as Portland State, have a first application complete, first student served method of doing business. So when we look at the Oregon Supplemental Tuition Grant, we award that on a yearly basis, and we do not promise a student who might have received it as a freshman that he or she will get it the next year, because it's a need-based program, similar to federal need-based programs. Even though a student might be needy from year to year, if that student does not meet a deadline, et cetera, we have a finite sum of money to award each year, and therefore we award to those first students. And so some students who apply a little bit later may not may not receive a need-based program, and there's no implicit or direct promise that a needy student will always get a program in a need-based program. That's significantly different from the programs where we have students who have an implied and, in some cases, a written promise that we will, those programs are renewable. And to put some of the fee remissions in perspective, at our campus, we give a student who's eligible for an Oregon Supplemental Tuition Grant, the need-based program, $900 a year, $300 a quarter. So if you have a freshman who's high need and who has applied early enough, that freshman can get, this next year, can get a $4,000. Our costs are a little over $15,000. That freshman can get a $4,050 Pell Grant if they're the highest need. An Oregon Opportunity Grant of about $1,300, that exact figure escapes my mind. Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant, which is a federal program, of $900, that's our criteria. A Work Study Grant, an Oregon Supplemental Tuition Remission of $900, and then we get into the loans. And so it's a very important part of our packaging, but it is a, in terms of percentage, on our campus, the majority of aid is loan. This year, we've dispersed over $91 million of aid. 60% of that, give or take, is loan. So the fee remissions are a very important part of our packaging and our access funding, if you will. And many of the students from different backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, the Hispanic population, for example, certainly want to come to college, but they really don't want to borrow very much. And for years, before students from the Vietnamese culture came to our campuses and became more integrated into our society, those students would always accept work study and free money, the grants and the remissions, but they had an adverse attitude about accepting loans. So they're incredibly important parts of our access funding.
Representative Marks.
Yeah. So if someone comes in as a freshman, they meet the timeline qualifications, they have the need. At their sophomore year, they still have the need, and they meet the timeline, they would presumably, there's a presumption that they would get a grant again.
That's correct. However, that same student, for whatever reason, let's say that same student in the freshman year met the timeline and was high need, in the sophomore year met the timeline and was high need, and then for whatever reason in the junior year didn't meet the timeline, but they were high need, and our funding had been used, then that student wouldn't be awarded the fee remission at that time.
But the presumption is there, if they meet the deadlines,
yes,
it would continue.
Yes.
Okay, that's the point.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, again, I have to apologize. I'm trying to catch up from being gone. I'm going to have to leave in a few minutes. You guys are the messengers here because you're from Portland State, but I did have a question that might help us understand these programs better and maybe would allow us to not only understand them, but once we understood them, we'd be more supportive of them. I want to cut to the chase on the NEED program and the diversity program. Is it possible for us by campus to get the percentage of people of color in those programs and gender? And when I'm talking people of culture, I'd like to divide out Asian versus other people of culture, of color, because we know there's a diversity there also. And if we could look at something of that nature to really see if we're impacting those parts of our community we want to, as far as getting them into higher education and getting graduated, if the remission program is a significant part of that, that would be very helpful to me.
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, we provided that type of data yesterday. What we didn't do is perhaps at the level of individual fee remission categories. However, we do have it by ethnic group in the fee remission program overall. So by campus, you can see how many African-American students at Portland State University received a fee remission for each of the last 3 years, how many Hispanic students and such. If you would like additional details so we can actually break it down by diversity versus the supplemental fee, we can provide that level of detail. But we have provided you the aggregate data And I think the data is actually quite supportive of the fact that these programs have helped us increase the diversity of our campus enrollments.
Madam Chair, I very much like that information. And I do want more focused on the communities I've just mentioned.
Absolutely.
Because my experience has been those are the communities we're trying to impact our society in and move them on to higher education.
Representative Bates, Chair Morgan, we will provide data as discreetly as our data collection allows regards to race. We do have some constraints there.
I understand that. Thank you.
Senator Gordley.
Madam Chair, just an observation. For the past couple of days now, we've been talking about a program that is of benefit to students and without hearing any input from students. And so, again, that's just an observation. I know that we're not in public hearings. We're in a work session.
Again, Senator Gordy, we did have input from students during the public hearing on the bill. And I
realized that, and that was why I said I realized we're not in public hearing. We're in a work session. It's just striking to me that we've spent the last couple of days talking about a program that benefits students, but we're just not hearing that perspective again to affirm or clarify the issues that we're talking about. That's the only point I'm making.
Okay. And we also are moving along here like a herd of turtles.
Yes,
we need to. Getting me out of the room will make that move a lot faster for you. So I'm doing this for the good of the order.
Okay.
I'm sorry to apologize. I'm just catching up. I'm sorry.
I'd recommend Dr. Bates. This I just looked at the one from Southern Oregon. It shows the place of the state, the Southern Oregon's plus the opportunity grant made it possible for the student to go.
I believe that does that conclude all of the displays that you've brought before us that deal with the fee remission issue?
That is correct, Chair Morgan.
Thank you very much.
Oh, excuse me. One correction, Chair Morgan, is that a whisper in my back ear here. The union due question that was brought forward yesterday, we have confirmed that fee remissions are not used to pay for graduate student union dues, and that is part of the information.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bender, I'm going to rely on you to move us ahead here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You were earlier working through the memo that was distributed on Tuesday, the LFO recommendation on this bill, Part 1. And in your discussions, you got through or to item 5 on that list, which is on page 3, the vacancy savings adjustment. And there had been some discussion about the proposal that the Legislative Fiscal Office was proposing in order to apply vacancy savings to this particular budget, given the uniqueness of how higher ed is budgeted. We ended up with the committee asking higher ed and LFO to look into this further, and I would like to distribute to you a letter now, which is a response by Tom Andrus to this issue, and we can discuss this next. I know. I'm trying to have to hand them all out at this time. In this letter, to categorize this, and certainly Mr. Andrus may wish to come forward. They are proposing that for faculty positions, which represent approximately 25% of the OUS employee population, that a vacancy savings not be applied against those salaries because universities have been using those vacancies, the savings from those vacancies, primarily to hire adjunct faculty to continue to offer the course sections. That is what they are proposing as an alternative.
Mr. Bender, could you give the committee the benefit of LFO's opinion on this?
Well, LFO would not support the alternative that OUS is proposing. The reason why is what they are essentially describing is a situation where they have a high demand for their services, and to the extent that they have faculty positions which are not full, they're using those funds to hire alternative people, adjunct faculty, in order to continue to provide the course sections and the courses as much as possible. And this is, of course, you know, very sympathetic to the concerns that the system has in continuing to provide services in light of budget reductions. However, given the this is a very similar situation that many, or in fact most state agencies are finding in this budget cycle. There are few state agencies that are actually finding their workload being diminished by some external factor. Rather, as the state is trying to address its severe budget situation and we're looking for savings, we are going through looking at other state agencies, looking to the extent that there are vacancies, and to the extent that those vacancies do not critically need to be filled and funded in the upcoming biennium, for other state agencies, subcommittees are recommending that those positions and the funding for them be eliminated in order to help address the state budget situation. I would suggest that this is a very critical, that LFO is looking at these situations critically in other agencies. I think that the number of positions that are being reduced as a percentage of those that are vacant is not turning out to be especially high, and in fact, some members may be disappointed with LFO recommendations that are saying that so many of these really need to be continued. That's another issue, but what are, given the fact that we are going to be using that percentage of what the subcommittees actually approve after going through this critical process of seeing which positions can be eliminated and which are necessary to continue, it would seem that for equity purposes and because of the needs, you know, the severe state crisis in funding, that it would be reasonable to apply this same method for teaching faculty. Again, to the extent that there aren't vacancies amongst teaching faculty because there isn't turnover, I think that's a somewhat different issue. And we'd be happy to look into that, but there's no data on that particular issue. Instead, the proposal was that, well, even when we have these vacancies, we need to use that money to provide the services that we're providing. And that is a very, that's the same type of situation that every other state government agency is in. They still need to provide the services. So I don't see whereas this is a compelling argument. I would note, though, that the LFO recommendation would be to reduce the amount of tuition revenues that could be spent for vacant. In other words, when vacancy savings are found, we will be recommending that you reduce not only the general fund, but the amount of tuition dollars that would have been spent on that position. Under the understanding that tuition rates are going up a great deal, and if there are positions that aren't strictly necessary, we'd like to be able to reduce the burden of increased tuitions as much as we're reducing the burden on the state general fund. However, you may want to consider as an alternative to not reduce those tuition amounts. This would again be an exception for the way that vacancy savings are being handled in every other state government agency, and therefore the co-chairs, you know, would certainly be interested in whether you took this position. But if you do feel a concern that this would be onerous to higher ed's ability to provide the services and that you do feel that students would be willing to cover these costs in tuition, that would be an alternative, but I would not personally recommend the alternative that higher ed has proposed.
comments. Representative March, what
I have grave concerns about that recommendation. We have a situation where, unlike a lot of other state agencies, students are paying a greater percentage of higher ed's cost than the state is, and as well as other funds. And so that's one critical factor. Secondly, in our in these economic times, we have more people seeking new skills through higher education so that they make themselves employable. In as we come out of the economic doldrums, that they'll be employable in the new economy around them. As we just heard from Portland State, they have more applications now than they've ever had. They've got record numbers of students coming in, and those students are demanding classes. I mean, they need classes to attend. There's going to be vacancies. One of the problems is recruiting faculty is gotten more difficult. It used to be we said Oregon was a great place to come and stay. We can't offer you the best salary, but we have a great retirement system. Well, the retirement system's changed. So we have a great state. So our recruitment efforts, we have lower salaries than a lot of other peer institutions. We've got a lot of factors here that I think make higher education, and actually all of education at the post-secondary level, different than other state agencies.
The, Representative March, how do you get, I would ask, from what I just heard you say, I think that you could clearly substitute the Department of Human Services, for example, for what you just said about the Department of Higher Education. Certainly there's more people that are in the economy that we're in that find themselves in a position where they need the kind of services that the department offers. And certainly in order to provide those services, the Human Services Department is going to be very stretched, given that we are going to be looking very vigorously at the vacant position issue in that agency also. And I recognize that there in the university system are needs to educate students, but I think that there also are needs here to address the fiscal situation that the state finds itself in, and to be able to come to a reasonable conclusion. I think that one of the things that we're finding, and we're going to find it in the university system just as we are in city government and county government and other areas of state government, with the PERS situation being what it is, there's a tremendous amount of people that are choosing this time to retire. And so there are going to be a higher level of vacancies than there would normally be just by virtue of the issue that's presented by PERS. And that to treat this agency differently from other agencies, I think, is a slippery slope to get on. And that the discussion should rather be around how to do this in an equitable and meaningful way across the system, rather than allowing everybody to occupy their little niche in this. That's a different way of looking at it.
Well, as one of the options laid out was to treat the state funding differently than tuition funding, and my recommendation would be that if students want to continue to come and they're paying, unlike most human service programs, where the state is picking up 100% of the tab, we have students who are paying a good share of the tab. And if they continue to come, why would we turn away customers? And you know, paying customers, in other words, as a business, you know, if you're looking at it as a business model, you've got customers at the door with cash who want classes. And we're telling them the universities can't spend the money on the classes that are being demanded. It's not a good business model.
Well, I think, Representative March, very respectfully, that there's a balance there, because it is a pretty even balance at this point between general fund and tuition, in my understanding, and I will ask for clarification for that on LFO, so that there are clearly considerations beyond the students picking up the tab, that we have an obligation here to balance the spending over all areas of state government. And Mr. Bender, could you clarify the relationship between tuition and general fund?
The tuition and general fund amounts are roughly at this point in the 50-50 range, and depending upon what the final budget approved is, are likely, I think it's likely to be that the general fund will be less than the 50%, and the tuition and fees would be higher than the 50%. So we're roughly at that split level, and the final outcome is still unknown.
And I would stress to the committee members that there are quite a number of unknowns here, including what the tuition levels will be and how much money that'll generate. And then, of course, the general fund piece is unknown at this time, too. So this is another one of those exercises in trying to get certainty out of something that's very uncertain.
And, Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon.
I would suggest as well, again, looking at an overarching perspective, I think there's another question. Does this take us down the path of further diminishing, diluting the quality of offerings within our university system? I think that's the overarching issue in my mind. And I think that it requires a response from the department as well.
Mr. Anders.
Tom Andres with the Oregon University System. A number of issues here. One, I think, that's maybe the basic of all of this is that one of the reasons that we took the approach to talk about the vacancy savings and how that's used, in a sense, it's recycled. It was not because the faculty as a rate of turnover is lower or higher. It's because we didn't have the data. And Mr. Bender was absolutely correct on that. I think we believe that the turnover rate for faculty is lower. And if that is the case, and as they represent 25% of the overall employee base, then our sense of it is that should be a lower figure. I can't confirm that. I cannot give you hard data on that. So the concept was that as the faculty position turns over, those dollars are then continued in a faculty line to provide instruction. And again, it's true that human resources or human services, other agencies can do that same thing. I think from our perspective, we've had growing and growing demand, and we've had this tension between what do you do with tuition, what do you do with the general fund dollars that you have through the model, and how do you balance the access and the affordability? And I think where we're at right now is as each of these items are added on top, what we're really doing is we're going to have an impact on access. If we have a limitation that says that you're going to get so many dollars and you're going to take away inflation and vacancy savings and so forth, what we're going to be trying to do is stay at a particular level, a sell value, if you will, tied to our peers. And that's going to be at 72%. That is a board position. What that will do is when we get a dollar figure, that will end up driving to a particular enrollment. And that's just background. I mean, that's what will happen under any circumstance, no matter what you do. But I think on the tuition piece, which becomes awfully important to us, is that we have some flexibility. We have some capability that not simply as an attempt to backfill general fund as it's reduced, but there is a commitment. There is a huge access issue out there. And if access under the general fund is declining, then that additional tuition dollar will give us an opportunity to meet what is a growing demand. Again, one can equate that to the services that are provided through the rest of the state agencies. You know, we're going to have to limit services. But here we have an opportunity that's a dollar that's outside the general fund. It's outside in the sense, I mean, you certainly have oversight and responsibility, but it's outside in terms of the 13, 12, 11 billion dollar decline. It is an opportunity, I think, as Representative March said, to have some margin of dollars to help us continue to meet the access requirement as the general fund declines. Again, I actually have to apologize because I would think we should have more data on our vacancy factors specifically for faculty. And I can sit here and say this is what I believe, this is what I know, and I do believe that. But ultimately, those vacancy dollars have been recycled back into instruction so that we can maintain access. And maybe that's kind of the core issue for the board and where we're going.
Mr. Anders, do I hear you saying that there is no possibility of actually getting vacancy information out of the faculty side of OUS?
Madam Chair, we do have vacancy information. We know what the positions are. We have data. I would be hard-pressed to come up with what I think is good, solid numbers on a long-term vacancy rate, though. I mean, we have to present vacant positions through the governor's, I think it's the governor, or is it? If it's through the governor's requirements, we have to provide vacant positions, and we have to identify how they would be used, if they'd be eliminated, are they going to be filled. That's frankly a system that's evolved and one that needs to be refined. But I'd have to say, no, I could not tell you right now, using that set of information, that here's a vacancy factor that runs across the system that's 2% or 3% on an annual basis. And that's something we need to refine.
I'm not understanding the nature of the problem. If you have to report this information to DAS, isn't there some kind of information going back in time that would be applicable to the situation?
Madam Chair, we do not have good historical extended data, no. From the point that we moved out of the state system, where we were part of the state personnel system, and we moved out in 99 or 2000, we've begun to create what is in effect a budget control system or an oversight system. But right now, we do not have the kind of data, say going back to even 01, that would allow us to say here is a vacancy factor for faculty.
Mr. McGee, would you be so kind as to come forward and give us some perspective before the 99 biennium?
Chair Morgan, for the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. What Mr. Andres is referring to is a vacancy adjustment that we make in the governor's budget. And what that is, how we do that is we take a snapshot at one point in time and look at the vacancies over the prior year, project that for a full biennium, and then take that as an adjustment each biennium. We don't really retain the historical data that would allow you to do the kind of long-term projections that Mr. Andres is talking about. It's a snapshot in time that's applied each biennium when we prepare the budget. Not sure that was helpful.
Well, I still have to ask a question then. If it's a snapshot in time that's been taken in each biennium, why isn't that data available?
We could probably attempt to go back into old files and dig out the reports in each year. That's generally not something that's readily available. We have a dollar adjustment biennium. We turn it into a plus or a minus based on the past year's history, but we don't usually retain the paper reports that list each of the positions. It's even more difficult for OUS, who for some time now have not been on the state's position control system, so we have to work with them to attempt to replicate what we have for other agencies on a position-by-position basis. So we convert everything into a dollar adjustment each time rather than keep the individual position history that I think Mr. Andrews is talking about that would allow them to break out faculty versus non-faculty and then make historical projections about what their vacancy history is.
And Madam Chair, I would just say that we have absolutely no argument whatsoever in terms of a vacancy factor as it relates to 75% of our employees. There should be no difference in terms of the non-faculty side. So, you know, maybe I'm dwelling on a point that's not worth it, but there is just that quarter, I guess, of our population that may be different. Yeah. Madam Chair, Mr. McGee has, I think, identified a good point. We have created in the last year and a half or so what we call it's a budget control system, and links it as we move from what is the PICS. Mm-hmm. As we move from PICS into our new system, we've tried to create that as it relates to our job categories and so forth. And I think the point that I was making is it really hasn't refined to the degree that we have both the historical information on the vacancies and on the position categories. And I would hope within the next year, probably year and a half, to have that as detailed as possible and being able to identify positions by the campuses, by type, and have good summaries.
Well, let me just make sure I'm understanding this. That in order to do the governor's budget recommendation, each biennium, you bring forward some kind of analysis on the amount of dollars that you feel are involved in vacant positions, or somehow you evolve to the point where you figure out how many dollars are involved in vacant positions. Isn't there a mechanism by which you have some average cost of faculty that you could extrapolate a vacancy rate from that number?
Madam Chair, we probably could. But it would be just that. It would be an extrapolation, and I'd be telling you today, here's what we think. Here's what it probably is within some range. And I really think in the discussions that I've had with Mr. Bender, and probably what you're doing right now at the agency level, where you're literally going through each position and identifying each position, what we would be presenting would be just very much very general. It could be something that would provide additional information, but it certainly wouldn't be at the level of what you're receiving now from other state agencies.
Mr. Bender, do you have thoughts on this?
Well, I think that because of this, the availability of the data, and also because of the fact of how the state is actually budgeting for higher ed, where you are not funding positions specifically. We have position information, but we do not look at people, count, add them all up, and add up their salaries and compensation and put that particular calculation in the budget. Because of those differences, that is why LFO made the recommendation that we did as to how to approach this. We believe that the most reasonable way to approach the issue of vacancy savings, given those factors, is to see what is happening throughout state government and other state agencies where we are able to look at this at a position-by-position basis. And since we don't have specific information that would lead us to automatically conclude that higher ed's experience would be higher or lower than this average, just to apply that.
Mr. Bender, I do most definitely lean towards your position, and absent any other information that we can get that attempts to approximate what the vacant positions are in some kind of way within the faculty piece of the OUS system, I don't know how we're going to justify completely excluding that piece from this function. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I would agree with you also. I think that as a legislative body, we have a right to know what we're buying. And to me, through this whole discussion, I've been thinking, I don't know how many instructors you have for journalism or whatever is. That's what you're telling me. If you can't come to me with your vacancies, you also can't come to me with the alternative, with the opposite is true. Well, how many journalism instructors do you have? How many biology instructors do you have? And then what's left over? So I want to know what I'm buying. And I think that is an important part of this discussion.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we do have that information. I think my point was the historical context of being able to provide a factor over a period of time. We can provide information by departmental budgets. That really is not the problem. It's coming back to you, and I'm trying to be honest. We do not have a simple factor that says this is what it is based on verifiable data. That's all I'm trying to say at this point.
And I think that what we're trying to say is that absent any kind of data that gives us an actual picture, I'm not willing to presume that there's no vacancies. And I think that it is going to be difficult to to pass this budget out without just saying, well, we're assuming there's no vacancies, that this part of the budget should be immune. I don't see how we can get to a place where we can justify taking that kind of a position without any kind of data to support doing that.
Madam Chair, I would not disagree with you.
Any other comments that anyone wants to make on this issue? Otherwise, I think we should forge ahead here, given that we don't have a quorum to go ahead and work on the budget note.
Okay. Madam Chair, I will ask for your assistance here in choosing where to go next at this point. There are a couple of items that I think it would be helpful to discuss, and one of them would be to talk about compensation increases and what we expect to happen with the Oregon University system there. Another item, however, that we did not cover yet was the performance measure review. And I know that we have people here who are, yes. Oh, okay.
What I'm thinking, and if I might just to the chase, is we've had some pretty interesting discussions about the problems that are caused by the discrepancies in the accounting systems between the OUS system and ORBITS, which is the state system. And this has been an ongoing issue, in my understanding, and there is, I have a great deal of interest, and I would like to have the committee discuss the issue of a budget note that would help move this reconciliation process along. Would it be possible to take up a discussion on that issue?
Oh, certainly. And the issue that the chair is referring to is number 7 on page 4 of the memo that you're looking at. I'll just read some of this to you verbatim, but the ORBITS section, ORBITS is the acronym for the budget system that the state is now using, and the ORBITS section is the division of DAS that maintains that system. The ORBITS section of DAS has reviewed the integration of the budget and accounting systems for all state agencies. State agencies maintain one system where we determine, where we track what they are budgeted to do, and another system where we actually record the actual expenditures. That would be the accounting system. And the ORBITS section of DAS looked at this, and they discovered that different state agencies had the structures or the way that they put their expenditures by category compared to the way expenditures are categorized under the budget system. They compared for agencies how consistent or integrated those two structures were. And they found that this varied from agency to agency, and they identified 7 state agencies that they believe would need to make significant changes, not in their ORBITS per se, but more in their accounting structures, to bring the two systems more integrated and into line. And the co-chairs have asked subcommittees to consider including a budget note for these 7 agencies, one of which is the Oregon University system, to do the following, and I'll just read that. It would say the Department of Higher Education is directed to match its accounting program structure in RSTARS, that's the acronym for the accounting program, and budgetary structure in ORBITS, for the execution of the 05-07 biennium budget. This action will more easily link accounting with budgetary information as directed in the statewide financial master plan approved by the 1989 legislature. The Budget and Management Division and Legislative Fiscal Office will approve these structures and work with the agency to ensure timely implementation A report and plan will be presented to the Ways and Means Committee during the 2005 session on agency progress and meeting these timelines. To the extent that you are in subcommittees where you have any of the six other agencies that are also categorized thusly, you'll see the same budget note being proposed. And if you look at it, what it is saying is that by the time the agencies are planning to actually spend what you appropriate to them in the 2005 session, we're expecting to have a system whereby the structure of how those expenditures are categorized is integrated with the structure and how they are budgeted.
So what I would assume then, Mr. Bender, is that what we're trying to do is move into a place where what is reflected in the state's budget program is mirrored in the higher ed budget program, and there isn't a lot of rewiring that has to be done to get the numbers to match up.
Yes, that would be certainly one of the outcomes of this. We would be able to receive information more directly at any point that would compare the actual expenditures by categories with expenditures as they were budgeted.
Mr. Anders, do you want to comment on this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are fully supportive of this. I think we want to not be put in a position of always talking about how we're different and being different for one reason or another. And I think this is an excellent opportunity on a very major level to bring us together as much as possible.
Well, I would assume also that it would have that you have to put quite a bit of work into translating what comes out of your system into a place where it can be received by LFO, and I would imagine that there is a lot of questions and answers and work that has to go in right now to the process of realigning, and that as this budget note process is moved down the road, that it'll facilitate that dialogue and save some time in the checking and the reworking that's become necessary.
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct. I mean, that's what we hope is the outcome. I think if we get to the point of looking at the fund balances and the cash flows, there are some really excellent examples of how we treat things differently, and how I think that can be migrated so that we're all looking at the same dollars at the same times in the same way. And this is probably the only way that it would happen.
Thank you. Did anyone want to ask questions or comment on this? Senator Gordon, are you okay with this?
I am, yes.
Representative?
I am fine with it. Thank you.
Can we go on and do the debt service discussion?
We can certainly do that as well. The debt service program area, as it comes to you in the governor's balanced budget, does not include sufficient general fund to pay debt service on Article 11G bonds that have been issued. It was an error in the development of the amount that was put in. There were certain bond series that were not included in the debt service, but these bonds have been issued, and the debt service is due, and constitutionally the source of repayment of this debt service is the general fund. So we are recommending debt service needs to be paid. We are recommending that you increase the debt service amount in the, the general fund amount in the debt service program area by the amount of $4,536,750 to cover this debt service. That is also when the co-chairs put out their revised budget. They were aware of the situation and they accommodated this increase.
Mr. McGee, do you concur with this?
Madam Chair, Bill McGee, for the record, this adjustment is in the governor's revised budget as well.
Thank you.
So we do.
Do you, Mr. Anders, do you wish to comment on this?
Madam Chair, just that we appreciate the addition. Thank you.
The debt service is one of those things that we found is very difficult to take any economies in, and we just generally have to bite the bullet on it. Does any member of the committee wish to comment on this or have an objection to it?
No.
Okay, we don't have a quorum here to actually adopt these, but perhaps we could now, Mr. Bender, swing back and deal with the compensation issue, and then I end up getting through with this one.
Okay.
I thought it'd be good to do a couple of easy ones.
Reminder, compensation increases. The co-chairs, in their budget, they are not financing compensation increases for state agency employees. This particular budget that comes to you as the governor's balanced budget also does not finance, or already I should say, does not finance any increases for compensation for state employees, for the employees of the Oregon University system. So in that sense, there's nothing that you would have to do in order to make this consistent with the co-chair's budget. But LFO, because higher ed is on a separate a personnel system, we were recommending the adoption of a budget note to clarify that the adopted budget does not support any increases in salaries, wages, or benefits for the employees of the department during the 2003-05 biennium, and the subcommittee expects no such increases to be awarded. The department is concerned about a need to allow some flexibility in a limited set of circumstances, and I believe they're available to discuss that if you would like to hear from them.
Please. Mr. Jones.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, trying to stay within the confines of not different but hoping for special in this very limited case. It's a request for consideration of the faculty compensation issue and our ability to recruit and retain individual faculty who become the subject of attempts to hire them away for other institutions. So this is not a request to permit general salary increases. This is not a request for funding of such increases or of such individual exemptions. The only argument that we could make for such an exemption would be that for us, for this group of employees, for faculty, they are uniquely employed from a national pool to a degree that I think is very high within state government. I do not have figures of how many employees in other state agencies are drawn from the national pool, but virtually all of our faculty hires are drawn from a national pool, and when we lose faculty, we lose them to institutions from other states almost entirely. As a result, the conditions here in Oregon do not act to help us at all. And when we're out trying to recruit faculty from other states, we have to deal with that. When we're trying to retain our own, we have to deal with that. Our fear is, and we understand the prohibition on general salary increases for all employees. We fully understand that. But in the course of the next couple of years, as other states start to recover from their economic woes, our faculty salaries are at the bottom of all of our peer lists and are substantially below national average. We know that we're going to be the target of cherry picking. We know that we're going to be the target of selective hires for recruits from other institutions. And what we're seeking is the opportunity for us to make limited exceptions in the case of recruiting and retaining specific individual faculty members for whom we would need to go outside the existing compensation levels. We would be more than happy to report on those fully, to report on those to our own board and through to you, and to make clear and transparent what our market is in this area. But our concern is that let me put it this way, we're asking for this exemption so that we can retain those faculty who will be most likely to be recruited away from us in the next year. These are specific individuals for whom specific retention packages would be developed, and we would report those packages to you in their full detail, other than by the name of the person. We'd report title, we'd report the amount of the difference, we'd report how far that goes above existing levels.
Mr. Jarvis, do you have any way of estimating, and I know this is a really difficult thing to try to do, but the scope of this program? Are we talking about what percentage of the faculty are likely to fall within the request that you're making?
Madam Chair, I'm afraid I can't really put a percentage number on that, and in some ways the percentage is perhaps not the key issue for us. It would come down to, for example, a researcher with a large and active lab that another institution knows. If they can pull that person away, the lab goes with them, the graduate students go with them, all of those funds go with them. if we're not able to maintain some sort of flexibility to retain that person, then we're simply going to lose a number of our most mobile faculty.
Could you give us, from the historical point of view, how much this has been a factor that you've had to deal with in the past?
Madam Chair, I can't give you an aggregate figure. I can ask the council. I have been in consultation on this specific matter with each of the presidents in the last 36 hours to say to them, are you feeling this pressure from other institutions? And they're all very worried about their more mobile faculty, and I emphasize mobile faculty, becoming the subject of recruitment offers. And this is a battle that we're in all the time. We're always trying to defend our faculty and to retain those. We're also out trying to recruit other people's faculty. And that's how we compete and bring in most faculty who come with experience and build large programs come with those sorts of packages. The packages are way above the normal offer. We have to do that. So we're looking for the ability to continue to do that for individual cases, and I stress for individual cases, some of which would involve a significant dollar figure, others would be much less.
So you say that this has been a significant issue in the past as well.
Madam Chair, this is indeed how faculty are recruited and retained.
Are we talking about the potential for every single faculty member to be in this category? What I'm trying to do is quantify what we're committing to if we agree to this.
Madam Chair, no. Every faculty member would not be in this category because we wouldn't be asking for the funds to support it. We'd be asking for the flexibility to accommodate this within the existing limited funds. So the campuses would have to make their own adjustments to fund these differences out of their existing budgets. Therefore, they couldn't afford to retain every existing faculty member. This is to retain the most mobile, and it would depend campus by campus on the number of predatory offers that they receive.
Madam Chair, if I might, Mr. Kearns, could you move this discussion on quantification along at all?
Madam Chair, for the record, Gretton Kearns, Director of Government Relations in the Oregon University System, not in terms of actual numbers, but what I think we're talking about, the reason the Chancellor asked me to come up was that he surveyed all of the presidents, give you a little background, on this language and the concepts which I developed, wrote these words which you've got in front of you, shared those with the presidents, and they are all very much in favor, very strongly in favor. We're talking about I'll use the term that Chancellor probably wouldn't, stars. We're talking about people who are very high profile, very high valued faculty who can be cherry picked or plucked out. If we have a position where we have no response to an outside offer, the only thing we can do to that person, that faculty member, is to say goodbye. And this language would allow the president, the provost, and the dean of that department or college to say, rather than goodbye, within the resources of this campus, make a counteroffer if they wanted to make one. I think we're talking about a small number of individuals. That's in retention. Recruitment is the reverse of that. The problem that we have is that, let's take the three research universities generally of the PhD granting universities in public in the United States. Our three PhD granting universities are in the bottom decile, and it's to say 90% or more have average faculty salaries above ours. And in order to recruit in someone to maintain program quality, to expand program quality, you need to have a package that brings that star or that advanced faculty member to you. The reason that the second paragraph is written the way it is to give you a report on each faculty line where this occurred. And the assumption is that it would be a relatively small number because it's only those that stand out where the president, the provost, the dean have to say, this won't be funded by the state. We have to fund it within our own reduced resources. Is this the case where we want to do this? And if we do, do we want to report it to the chancellor, the board, and the legislature? And so it would it would squeeze it down to those critical cases where you would want to do this.
And I'm going to break in here because Representative Smith has a question and Senator Gordley has a question. But in the last few minutes, what I would like to do, because we have a quorum of the committee present right now, to go through and vote on issue number 7 and issue number 8, and then take this issue back up when we begin our discussion tomorrow. Committee members, Senator Mezzili, while you were gone, we had a discussion about the budget note that is in Section 7 of Mr. Bender's memo. And functionally, what this does is continue a program along that will help align the accounting system in the higher education area with the accounting system that the state has. So I would ask you if you're okay with moving this.
Okay.
And then the issue around number 8 was that in the governor's balanced budget, there was an error in the amount of general fund that was needed to cover the debt service program for the system. And so this corrects this error. And we have concurrence from DAS and concurrence from OUS that this is the correct thing to do.
Fine.
So with that, I would take a motion to accept the LFO recommendation on the budget note for integration of accounting and budget structures and the budget note on the debt service adjustment.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Senator Gordy's made the motion. Is there a discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is carried. And what I'd like to do tomorrow, committee members, is we still have a couple of outstanding issues here. We have the standard rollbacks for inflation that we have to discuss. We have the vacancy savings issue that we have to discuss, and the compensation increases issue. I'd like to conclude the discussion on the compensation issue, which I don't think we've had the chance to have all the members weigh in yet and get their questions and concerns addressed, and then double back and see if we can't work with those other parts of the LFO recommendation.
Madam Chair, I have a request.
Yes.
Related to the compensation issue and retention and recruitment of faculty. If there are any pending situations that would fit the need for this exemption, if there is some immediate urgency that needs to be assigned to the exemption, would you come back and tell us what that picture is? Thank you.
That's an excellent point, Senator.
Very good.
Thank you. Did your issue involve a request for information?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I can wait till tomorrow.
What I'll do then is close the work session on House Bill 5021 and adjourn this hearing, and we will reconvene tomorrow morning after the full committee adjourns. In this room.